This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, November 4th, 2012. I'm Christina Thomas. Theater Squared's annual Gala for Education, presenting the 2012 Arts Advocate Award to Denise and Hershey Garner, will take place Thursday, November 15th at 6:30 p.m. The event, co-chaired by Lucy Arnez and Lawrence Luckinville, will benefit the theater's annual outreach to over 10,000 students and teachers. Tickets and more information available at theater2.org or by calling 445-6333. When you separate and teach little boys from little girls in a public classroom, do they act differently? And more important, do they learn differently? A growing number of Arkansas public school districts, including several in Northwest Arkansas, are teaching single-gender classes. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich attends one elementary school to learn more.
The cafeteria at Southside Elementary in Salem Springs is jammed with children enjoying cheese pizza for lunch. Here, boys and girls sit together, but when lunch is over, nearly half of them file into single-gender classes. Teacher Tammy Murray has instructed an all-boys class of fourth graders, one of 17 single-gender classrooms in the district, for the past 4 years, and she loves it.
You enjoy the stress. Thrill-seekers enjoy the stress of things, and so I kind of think of ourselves as thrill-seekers. We like the stress of the energy that the boys give us.
And results from the first year her all-boys class began to meet were really encouraging, she said.
100% growth. Every one of our students had made growth that year. And we have 4 points higher than the mixed classes for proficiency. So we have just a slight variation in our benchmark data.
Improving proficiency is what's leading more Arkansas school districts to adopt single-gender classrooms. Superintendents reported 72 such classes across 11 districts for this report, a preliminary tally. Tammy Murray and her colleagues teach self-contained classes, all the core subjects, to the same kids every day, same classroom. But she's taking things a step further and looping classes.
Okay, looping is the act of taking one class and staying with them through one, two, or more grades. Studies are showing what we learned, it's ideal if they'll loop three grades, but that's a lot of curriculum for a teacher to know.
By advancing to the next grade level with their students, teachers can pick up with them immediately every fall rather than having to assess a new flock of kids. Research on looping is scant, but evidence suggests that students score higher in reading, language arts, and math. So how does Tammy Murray keep pace with a pack of 28 little boys every single day for several years in a row?
It's exactly the same curriculum. It's just a matter of getting up and moving. For boys, move, 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 move. They can stand if they want to. They stand at the counter if they need to. They'll stand with a clipboard if they need to. They'll lay on the floor if they need to. We go outside, do lots of running. If you get a correct answer, you can run to the tree and come back. Just lots of movement.
Now compare that kinetic classroom scene to Julie McCraddock's all-girl fourth-grade class next door.
That armor on like a knight. That would be hard, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
All right. Javelin. What did you learn?
The girls take turns talking about a book they're reading on ancient Greek cultural practices. Evidence suggests that little girls tend to be more assertive when boys are not present. Tammy Murray's boys are taking a break from the books and gym class. The entire school sexually segregated for PE, which is tradition. But do the students prefer being separated during core courses?
They wouldn't be in here if they weren't into it, because they have the option to leave at any point, really. Parents have the option to pull out any time they want. They seem to be into it.
And do you have a preponderance of students and parents who want to be in the single-sex classrooms?
Yeah. We're always full.
Southside Elementary in Salem Springs is among a growing number of public schools nationwide experimenting with single-gender education. Outlawed in 1972 under Title IX of the Higher Education Act, single-gender classrooms were perceived as discriminatory. But 30 years later, gender-oriented classrooms were permitted under No Child Left Behind, which funded and encouraged innovation. According to the advocacy group, the National Association for Single-Sex Public Education, the number of public schools with single-gender classrooms has increased from 12 a decade ago to 508 nationwide. Even the U.S. Department of Education claims single-gender learning can boost achievement, reduce distractions, and improve behavioral interactions between both teachers and students, as well as among students. But empirical research is lacking, says Professor Sandra Stotsky.
There are teachers who have taught little boys and teachers who've taught little girls who claim that there are some differences in the way little boys learn and how they act in a classroom, so, and same with girls, so that there is some idea of gender-specific pedagogy.
Pedagogy meaning method or practice. A noted scholar in the Department of Education Reform at the University of Arkansas and an expert on standards for teacher education, licensure, and school curriculum, Professor Stotsky and her research team collected data from two elementary schools which had single-sex classrooms, in Springdale and in Fort Smith, the first study of its kind. She also observed same-sex classes in the co-ed school settings in other school districts.
No red flags, let me put it that way. We found very positive comments by the principal, the teachers, the few parents and students that we interviewed. No indication that there were any serious problems.
Stotsky's exploratory study, to be published in the Journal of School Choice this winter, searched for both positive and negative dynamics in non-co-ed classrooms.
We know girls do less well in math than boys, and we know that boys do less well in reading and writing than girls. So the question is, are there benefits for either sex or both sexes?
Educators also acknowledge long-held gender reading preferences, although those preferences are changing, Stotsky said.
Girls, as I say, like to read about fictional relationships, some fantasy stories. Boys do like nonfiction. This is a very clear preference. They like stories about sports. They like stories about exploits, adventures, wartime, battles.
Plus, girls act differently than boys.
Any mother who's had, or parent who's had children over the years will know that little girls can sit for long periods of time, read, or play school, play hospital, or play with dolls in carriages or little beds, you know, and little boys don't necessarily want to do this sort of thing. Sandbox play, there are some differences. Even when you try to put them all together in the same sandbox and insist that, you know, the girls play with trucks or whatever it is, these differences just occur.
Professor Sandra Stotsky says more exploration of single-sex education is needed in the face of rising demand.
The classes wouldn't be there unless the principal, the parents, and the teachers voluntarily wanted them.
An op-ed article published this month in the Wall Street Journal revealed an unusual bipartisan congressional alliance in support of single-gender education. But critics, like the American Council for Co-Educational Schooling, say single-sex classes are ineffective, claiming mixed-gender classrooms embrace diversity, promote cross-gender cooperation and friendships. And last May, the American Civil Liberties Union sent cease and desist letters to school districts in five states saying same-sex classrooms enforce stereotypes, limit opportunities, and violates children's civil rights. In response to a lawsuit brought by the ACLU, a federal court in West Virginia ordered a middle school to go back to co-education this school year. But Siloam Springs Southside Elementary principal Dan Siemens disagrees with critics.
Well, there are people in powerful places that, even politicians, that think that any kind of choice that a parent might have in public education is totally wrong. Now, if you talk to the parents of these boys, the parents of the girls in these classes that we have here, they would tell you the opposite. They love the choice. They appreciate the choice.
Plus, he said, in his school, an increasing number of students prefer single-gender classes.
The students just love it. They love the all-boys classes. They love the all-girls class. And we have done questionnaires, surveys, if you will, talking to the students about why do you like an all-boys class? Why do you like being in an all-girls class? And it's amazing how the answers are similar. The boys will say, there's no girls in here to mess up our class. But they just talk too much, and they just mess things up. Now, I'm generalizing here. But the girls say the same thing about the boys. You ask, girls, why do you like an all-girls class? Well, the boys come in, they're just so sloppy. They just mess things up in this class. And so it's amazing how the comfort level in an all-boys or all-girls class is there.
So for now, this big experiment in public education will continue. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is University of Arkansas freshman Trey Dudley, and also the Boys and Girls Club Youth of the Year, National Youth of the Year.
Yes.
Thanks for coming in.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
So, National Youth of the Year, Boys and Girls Club, what does that mean?
It's the highest honor that any Boys and Girls Club member can receive. So it means that now I'm the national ambassador for all of the 4 million kids that are a part of the Boys and Girls Club of America through the United States. So it's a huge, huge honor, and I'm super blessed to be able to hold the title.
Well, part of the reason you were chosen is because you have been involved with mm-hmm. your local Boys and Girls Club since you were, what, 5?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're now 18.
Yes.
So that's a long time. That's,
yeah.
Way more than half your life.
Yep, definitely.
So how did you first become involved?
Well, when I was in kindergarten, my mom was like, you know, kind of looking for a place for us to go after school because she was working all the time. So she didn't really have a place. So we went, and, you know, at that time it was just kind of I could go and have fun and, you know, relax and get my homework done, do whatever they had planned for the day. And then as I got older, it became more of like a relationship building program that kind of brought me out of my comfort zone and helped me find my different, different aspects that I had that I didn't know about myself. So, you know, they kind of brought out that confidence and that leadership that it was always deep down inside. I just didn't know how to, you know, express it. So, and it also helped me get through a lot of like trials and tribulations at home. So when I wasn't able to like be a kid that, you know, was going into it, I decided to start volunteering in junior high. And then in high school.
So instead of being the mentored, you became the mentor.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So and then in high school, I actually officially started working and I worked with second and third graders all through. Well, I guess at the time I was 16. So then
they started paying you to do it.
Yep.
Yeah. I read in your release that you met a couple of women that really had a big impact.
Yes.
On your life.
Jen Williams and Laura Wagner were my group leaders when I was in sixth grade. And that was kind of the time where things started to change. And, you know, my dad wasn't around anymore. So I was kind of going through the heartache of that. And then also, since he wasn't around, I was trying to be that father figure for my younger siblings. So I was taking on a lot of household responsibilities. I was telling them about like my lifestyle, and they're like, wow, you know, you do a lot for your age. And I never really thought about it. You know, it was just second nature to me. So then they kind of, I didn't talk to anyone about it. And I still had like that hurt from my dad being gone and stuff like that. So they gave me the chance to like express to them how I felt. And that's kind of when things started to turn around and I became, you know, more positive and found my confidence and stuff like that. So
have you had that kind of impact on another youth?
To get prepared for this competition, we did, locally, we had to go around to all of the different sites in my hometown.
And I guess we probably should locally for you was Lawrence, Kansas.
Yes, Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay.
So we had to go around and talk, give our speech to the different sites that we had. And there was one girl at my site who was actually in my group that I worked with who came up to me after my speech, and she was bawling. And like, just, she was like, I didn't know you went through this. She was like, I'm going through the same thing. And so from there on, we kind of had this special relationship where, you know, different comments that she would say or different things that she needed help with, I understood because, you know, I had been through that. So Yeah, there's been multiple times where, and I've also had kids come up to me and be like, oh my gosh, you're my role model. I can't believe you went through that. So it's really, it's such an honor to be able to, you know, have that kind of impact on kids now.
Right, for sure. So you mentioned preparation for this competition. So you had to enter to be considered for the National Youth of
yes.
the Year?
You got nominated by the staff. So actually, Miss Laura and Miss Jen were the ones that nominated me to be a part of it. And then you write like 8 scholarship essays on different, I guess, categories, like your home and family life, school, your community service, stuff like that. So you do 8 essays, and then one of those essays becomes your speech, and then you go through an interview process and give your speech at each level that you advance. So I did it locally, and then statewide, or regionals, and then nationals.
So which essay did you choose to speak about? Was it the home and family? Or?
It was What Boys and Girls Club Means to You was okay. the essay topic. So
have you already answered that question for me, what Boys and Girls Club means to you?
Mostly, yeah. It's like I said, it's been that home away from home, that family feeling that, I mean, I always felt like I have an amazing family. I always felt like I had family at home, but just kind of that extended family that I could go and talk to about issues that were going on at home because I didn't want to bring them back up while things were going positive, you know. Also bringing up my confidence and making me into the person that I am while helping do that. So it's meant definitely a lot more than just what most people go for, just like hang out and have fun with friends. It's kind of, if you take the opportunities that are given, it's a place to better yourself and, you know, become a better person, and that's what it's done for me.
So competition, how many kids were up for this? How many kids were nominated?
In my hometown, there were 4 of us, and then or 3 of us, 3 of us. And then regionally, there were 8. Statewide, I think there were 9. And then at nationals, there were 5 of us. So overall, within everyone, it's about 4,000 kids.
So when did you find out that you were chosen?
For
national, yeah.
It was.
Or as the national youth.
It was the beginning or middle of September. We were in Washington, D.C. at a congressional breakfast, and that's when they announced the winner.
So you had already, you knew that you had been chosen to be one of the 5.
Right.
And they brought you to Washington, D.C. in mid-September. Okay.
Right.
Congressional breakfast.
Yes.
What was that like? Who was there? I mean, Congress, right?
Right, exactly. It was amazing. There were so many people there. You know, they also had celebrities. So Denzel Washington was there, Michael Phelps was there, and Ashanti was there. So that was really cool, too, along with, like, the congressmen and all
the... Did you get to meet them?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. They, we had a Youth of the Year dinner the night before, and Denzel Washington and Ashanti were there, and they actually sat at our table. So it gave us a chance to kind of get to know them and talk to them, and they gave us some really good advice.
So yeah. they announce it, and then what?
And then I went up on the stage and said an acceptance speech.
Were you prepared?
No.
Did you think that you were going to win?
No, not at all. Not at all. The other 4 people were absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. It was, at that point, it was just kind of whoever gets it, we're all happy for them no matter what. So, but yeah, after that, I went up and said my acceptance speech, and then they took me off to go take pictures and went and did like media and press releases. And so it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy, but it was so much fun.
In addition to serving as an ambassador, you also got rewarded a scholarship.
Yes, ma'am.
From the Boys and Girls Club. A pretty good one.
Yep. It's actually from Tupperware and then the Rick and Susan Goings Foundation. I got $50,000 in scholarship money and just from winning nationals. And then I also got $10,000 for winning regionals and $1,000 for winning state. So overall, $61,000 in scholarship money.
That'll pay for a couple years for sure. For sure. That's good. So. Well, and a new car?
Is I did
that
get
what
a new
I
car.
What
I
kind of car?
I got a Toyota Corolla.
Okay. Well, so you're in Fayetteville now. Do you have plans to be involved with the Fayetteville Boys and Girls Club?
Are you
already?
I went last week and just kind of checked it out to see what it was. And I was amazed. I've never seen one look like that before. They have like a swimming pool and basketball, 2 basketball courts with a track that goes around the top of it, like a little workout place. And mine, all of the ones back home are all based in schools. And then we have 2 standalone sites, but one of them used to be a old elementary school. So it looks like a school. And the other one is the teen center. So it's not as big. But yeah, I was amazed. And I definitely want to get involved with that. With them, and then also just like different stuff on campus, because you know that's important too. So,
for sure.
Yeah.
So, what other things are you going to be involved in?
I know that I want to do the Volunteer Action Center and the Dream Big program that they have over there. because that's just right up my alley. That's exactly what I want to do. And then I'm a part of Student Support Services and Leadership Walton. That's good, too.
Already, yeah. So, yeah. You're moving and grooving just into the, you know, very beginning. I guess we're halfway through the semester now.
Yeah.
Your first year.
Yeah.
So as the National Youth of the Year, you said you'll serve as an ambassador. You know, will you go on, you know, various site visits? Will you meet with groups of, what sort of things will you do?
Right now, they have us doing a lot of I say us because a lot of the other finalists accompany me with it, but appearances, I guess, or like speaking engagements. So actually 2 weeks ago I was in New York and I was on the Today Show with Shaq. So
are you
that
serious?
Wow. That was really cool. And then next week I'm going to Atlanta to speak at the Southwest Gala through the Boys and Girls Club, and also wherever the World Series is, they're going to take me, and I have to throw the first pitch at the World Series. So that'll be pretty amazing too. So they have us doing a lot of stuff like that, just, you know, meeting new people and kind of being the spokesperson for the youth. So I hope to be able to, you know, visit different sites in various places, but a lot of times it's like speaking at different events. So
how are you able to handle all that in addition to being a full-time student?
It's not hard. It's just really time consuming. You have to make sure that you balance your time really well. So there's lots of times where I'll be on the flight trying to do my math homework or, you know, just different things that to throw in different times to get your homework done here and there. But it's not hard, and my professors are super understanding about it.
Did you ever think that you would be jet-setting around and having all of these awesome speaking opportunities? And
not at all. Not at all. It's definitely been like a dream come true, and I'm just trying to like soak it all in, you know, because it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. So I'm super, super blessed and honored to be able to do something like this.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
And, well, college will go by fast. I'm sure you've been told that before. So you're in the business college, and you love your, you know, you love community and volunteering. Where do you see yourself after college?
After college, I'm not 100% sure exactly what I want
to
do. But I know that ultimately I want to open a nonprofit for teens. So something right now, I just see like a lot of negative stuff that's going on in, you know, teens world, I guess. So I kind of want to do something to bring out more of the positive stuff that they do, because they do a lot of positive stuff. And so hopefully have a nonprofit for teens and help them transition from high school to college and, you know, to be able to be successful.
Okay. Well, best of luck to you, Trey.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I spoke with Trey Dudley, the Boys and Girls Club National Youth of the Year, early in October. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Just in time for the holidays, a new Northwest Arkansas-centric cookbook, created by the members of a Fayetteville church, delivers hundreds of recipes tested by the parishioners, and gives a snapshot of the region's past and present. The cookbook is titled Full Plate, a generous serving of Ozark hospitality. It was a 10-year project by members of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. 100% of sales go to support community meals at St. Paul's, where they feed hundreds of people every Monday and Wednesday at lunch. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums spoke with co-chair of the committee who created the cookbook, Christine Klinger, who says the initial idea sprang from an appropriate place.
I like to say that a lot of great ideas are stirred up in a kitchen, and this was one of them. In 2001, in the fall, St. Paul's hosted the Episcopal Church Women's Group that met. The whole diocesan group met in the old kitchen, well, in the old parish hall at St. Paul's, and we prepared the luncheon for them in the old kitchen. And I think maybe three of the four burners still worked on the stovetop, and the dishwasher didn't work. And so it was really around food and serving food and hospitality that the idea was sort of bantered about.
So you asked for parishioners and the like to submit recipes, and then people prepared them, but not people who submitted them.
Correct. The committee was one of those that expanded and contracted over time. But one of the rules that we had was if you submitted a recipe, the one that you prepared for our luncheon could not be your own, because it was really important to have somebody else use their cooking eyes to see if the recipe worked for them.
You know, one of the great things about a college town is that it attracts people from all over the country and all over the world. And while you do have some Ozark natives, you have people who've come from everywhere. And when you start flipping through this book, that becomes quite apparent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's not
good.
Just Ozark cooking here.
Well, I think maybe not in the traditional sense,
right.
But as the new Ozarks
exactly.
are evolving, I think it's very reflective.
So how difficult was it to get from 900 plus to 308?
Well, it was a lot of testing and tasting and a lot of fun. Lowell Grisham, our rector, referred to it as his favorite committee to be on at St. Paul's. And so I think we did evaluations, and we looked at that, the results of those, and just sort of not just the numerical indices, but we all sort of knew, you know, gut feeling whether this would be a recipe that we wanted to include in the cookbook. And we tried to have a balance of recipes that would be easy enough for a beginning cook, but also sort of challenging enough for a more experienced cook. So it was hard. It was a hard job, but somebody had to do it, and we did.
How many people were on the committee over time?
Oh, well, you know, at the beginning of the book, we list people who helped and contributed. I think, it would be really hard for me to say numbers, but I think during this last, the home stretch, it's been about a dozen of us that have stayed committed to it. I think a lot of people got weary and just thought, they're never going to finish this cookbook.
Well, yeah, you mentioned a 10-year process.
Mm-hmm.
Was part of that just inexperience with the publishing world or testing all the recipes? Everyone had other things to do?
I think it was a lot of that. And then life just got in the way. When we were just meeting once a month, it almost seemed for me that we'd barely come up from having had the last one when it would be time to coordinate the second one or, you know, the following one. Yeah, it just, we're all really, really busy people. And the community of people at St. Paul's are extremely busy cooking on Mondays and Wednesdays for community meals. And so Friday then would roll around and it would be time to have a monthly cookbook meeting. And we just sort of got stuck in the process, I guess you could say.
Monday and Wednesday community meals at St. Paul. That's what proceeds from this book
yes.
will help fund.
Yes, exactly.
What happens on those Monday and Wednesdays?
Well, a free warm, home-cooked, balanced meal is provided to anybody, hungry or homeless, or anyone in need of a meal. When they were building the Three Sisters on Dixon Street, the workers would come and have a meal. So we do no screening in terms of, proving your financial need, but it's well-received and often a very packed house.
You mentioned that when this started with the conversations, the old kitchen, the old stove. So that's changed. Different
yes.
stove.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else that you've noticed has changed between 2001 and 2012?
Well, yes. I think one of the things that we would say is an advantage of having taken this long to create a cookbook is that the way that we eat as a culture, we talk about slow foods. That's something that we didn't talk about in 2001. And I think that we've gotten some younger parishioners or people involved in the committee that have helped bring some fresh eyes, and I think it's really helped create a better balance. And the cookbook that we have today in 2012, I think is much more current than the one that, say, we had been able to publish it in 2 years would have been.
Great idea to have these sidebars. Every recipe page has a sidebar. Now, some of them are cooking tips,
mm-hmm.
What's the best temperature for if you're working with beef, but some of them are descriptions of Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park or Crystal Bridges or things like that. That's a wonderful sort of moment in time in Northwest Arkansas.
Yeah, I'm glad you appreciate that. When my husband opened the book, he said, wow, this is really two books in one. And I would have to give credit to T. and Roy Fuller for having that vision. I think when I began, I just was thinking of pretty much a spiral-bound cookbook limited to just our church parishioners. But they had gone to a seminar that Wimmer Publishing offered, and they went to Memphis with some other folks and came back very energized about creating a regional cookbook and one that had some local history in it. So it was really T. and Roy Fuller who had that vision.
And there's history of food here, of apple production, mm-hmm. you know, more than a century ago. I'm trying to find this one recipe. This is one that Katie Mihalovich,
yes.
who let me look at her book. I think the day she got it, she mm-hmm. brought it over so I could look at it beforehand. Mm-hmm. Boston Mountain Hot Chocolate. And the sub-headline on this is absolutely decadent.
And we've tested that. It is indeed.
That has an exclamation yes. point beside it as well. So.
Yeah, it is.
November 1st, which is a Thursday, is sort of the book release party.
It's the cookbook debut.
Yes, the cookbook
debut. And a little
debut.
Tasting. We plan that in conjunction with First Thursday and hope that we'll have a great turnout.
You know, other cookbooks I've seen like this that aren't quite as well done and well bound and as pretty, but still they'll have this recipe from so-and-so. There are no credits here for the recipes. They just exist.
Mm-hmm.
And in the front you have people who submitted recipes, mm-hmm. but no one is assigned credit.
Right. Well, that was something that we talked about, and when Wimmer, the publishing company, spoke to us about the trends in cookbooks, that's something that people are getting away from. And because we wanted it to have a more regional appeal, if it had been more of an in-house cookbook, I think there would have been some value to that. So we made the decision not to. But the other thing is quite a few of the recipes may have been similar or submitted by several different people. And so rather than give one person the credit with the recipe, everybody's given credit in the preface.
Christine Klinger was co-chair of the committee that developed the new cookbook, Full Plate, Generous Servings of Ozark Hospitality, produced by members of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. Proceeds will benefit community meal projects of the church.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums filed that report for a Daily Show earlier this week.
Later today on This American Life, everybody knows that politics is now so divided in our country. The two sides are like two different realities, two versions of the world in collision. This week on our show, we hear from people who have seen this infect their personal lives. They've lost friends. They've become estranged from family members. Our political civil war and its personal consequences. It's a special pre-election edition of our show later today.
This American Life, just after Weekend Ozarks at 10 o'clock. Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas, and joining me now is Katie Henriksen. She is host of Note throughout the week and on Sundays, Sunday Symphony.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, yeah, we have two amazing symphonies coming up tonight from 7 to 9. One of them is Mahler's Sixth Symphony, sometimes known as his Tragic Symphony, although he didn't actually like that nickname that was attached to it. And then Rayfawn Williams' Symphony No. 5 in D major. So two really awesome works.
So why did people call it the Tragic Symphony?
It's the ending, it's like a really crazy ending, and Mahler is very, I mean, if anyone who knows anything about his life and his how he composes, he's an extremely emotional person. So this is really, it sounds tragic and epic, and it's a really long symphony. It's like it's one of the symphonies you would want to play, because I get 2 hours to do a symphony in the show. So this symphony spans over an hour. It goes almost 80 minutes long. So, but it's a really brooding and dark and tragic, you know.
Right.
So,
but he did not consider himself, I guess, an emotional character. Probably.
Oh, he did, yeah. And it's funny that I believe the symphony was written between 1903 and 1904, which is supposedly a really good time in his life when he met his wife Alma Schindler. But if anyone who knows anything about that marriage, that was very tumultuous, and they ended up getting a divorce and everything. So. I don't know.
All right.
Glimpse into Mahler if you want to listen to this symphony. I think all of his music is, though. It's very, it's all very emotional. And you know, some people actually kind of discount him as a composer because of that, because he is so emotional and dark, and he maybe he's not quite as sophisticated as Mozart or something like that. Okay. So, but the another interesting thing is I found the two recordings I found. It's they're both American symphonies. So these are like Mahler is a late Romantic composer who was born in what is currently the Czech Republic. And so he's considered an Austrian composer. But so the symphonies are being performed here by the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. And then the Ray Vaughan Williams, who's a British composer, this is from the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. So, they're both I didn't even notice that. It's the same. Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. As Christina and I were talking about, we're both a little brain dead at this point because we had our fundraiser. So yeah. We're all in overdrive and everything.
So, yes, I know. I'm hoping for a very relaxing Sunday afternoon myself. And it might be kind of nice this evening to turn on the symphony and relax.
It's a good time to just sit there and listen to music and kind of decompress and get ready for the week at hand. Another thing about the Ray Vaughan Williams, it's kind of considered a more of a pacifist symphony because the symphony before that was really kind of bombastic, and he wrote it in the height of World War II, and he says it's an homage to Sibelius, although people who listen to Sibelius and listen to this symphony, they don't see any direct, there's not any direct elements from Sibelius in this symphony.
His name sounds a little bit more current to me, I guess. How old is Williams?
Yeah, he worked in the 20th century. So this symphony was composed, I'm not sure of the specific dates, but it was like during World War II. And then Mahler's was composed in the 20th century, but at the very beginning of the 20th century.
Okay, well, Sunday Symphony tonight from 7 to 9. With local host Katie Hendrickson.
Yes, thank you, Christina.
Thank you. The holidays are around the corner, but as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, the spirit of giving is already present for some in Northwest Arkansas.
The month of November brings the words giving and thanks into the collective consciousness of many as we move closer to winding down the year. Over the past week, we've featured a few stories that involved giving in some shape or form. For example, students at the University of Arkansas campus in Fort Smith last week completed a successful food drive. Members of the Criminal Justice Club at the university decided to raise food for the River Valley Regional Food Bank last month. Dennis Williams is the club's faculty sponsor. He says that the idea for the food drive came about after hearing a local news report in September about the food bank running low on supplies.
So they were trying to do a week of food drives and raise donations through that. I saw that, and as I became advisor, because this is my first year at UAFS, I was appointed advisor of the club, so I brought that to the club, and the kids were really enthusiastic about doing it. We got it going as quickly as we could, which would be about the 1st of October.
Williams says that the food drive, which ended October 25th, was a sizable success.
The food bank pointed out that, you know, the 1,100 pounds, they said their citywide food drives only raise about 2,000. And they said that UAFS is always doing food drives for them, but this one came in with quite a bit of food, more than average.
Williams says that the food drive was a good experience for members of the Criminal Justice Club, as many of the students who pursue a career in criminal justice will be faced with community service in their careers. And another food drive saw great success this past week. For the Full Circle Food Pantry on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville received tons of assistance. Food Pantry Director Angela Oxford says that the pantry raised 11,384 pounds of food and contributions as part of the Homecoming 5K food drive.
Last year alone, we received 16,000 pounds of food for the entire year. And so it's going to be enormous. What we've been finding is that our numbers continue to grow. We're serving over 200 students, staff, and their families every week. And so food goes quickly, and especially during the holidays because children are out of school and our students and staff who have families have children at home to feed. And so we see a greater demand during the holidays. And we do our very best to stay open as long as we possibly can during the week of Thanksgiving and also during Christmas and times when students are away.
To enter in the Five Cans Razorback 5K race, students were required to donate at least 5 cans of food to the pantry. The pantry still has thousands of cans of food still to be stored on shelves, and Oxford says that the work couldn't be done without the help of volunteers.
It takes a lot of hands to move the kinds of food donations we receive. Our ongoing volunteers who are actually serving in the pantry, you know, they're meeting our clients' needs. And so when we do those all calls, we really do need those extra hands who can come out and just help come in and stock and help us get the food weighed and sorted, because we really want to properly thank and honor the groups who give us food. And so we want to make sure we do a good inventory and keep track of what they're giving and to be sure and say thank you.
Oxford says that the pantry is always in search of other partner organizations for food drives, and on Thursday, the club sports program in the Department of University Recreation began its second food drive supporting the pantry. The food drive will continue through November 20th, and donations will be collected at the University Recreation Office on campus. For more information, visit newswire.uark.edu. And the third annual Kicking the Competition kickball tournament was held this weekend at Memorial Park in Bentonville. The tournament was open to everyone in Northwest Arkansas, but many teams came from the Walmart vendor community. Mary Case works within the vendor community and helps organize the event. She says that the event was created not only as a friendly tournament between competing vendors, but also as a way to raise money for local charities.
Well, it started in 2010. It's just an idea to raise money. At that time, it was supporting the ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and our local PepsiCo office, the Walmart team office. You know, we rally around some charities in the community every year. We were brainstorming unique ways to raise money, and we came up with the idea of the kickball tournament.
Teams of 8 to 12 people pay a $150 entry fee, and field sponsorships are sold for $100. Case says that before the teams even took the field on Friday, the tournament had raised more than $5,000 for the Northwest Arkansas Children's Shelter. That's three stories about giving, but here's one offering thanks. If you regularly listen to Ozarks, you're likely aware that we completed our fall fundraiser this past week here at KUAF. It was the most successful fundraiser ever here at the station, and we surpassed our goal of $160,000 by our deadline of 7 o'clock Wednesday night. But it wouldn't have been possible without the support of our wonderful volunteers or the businesses that provided food donations during the fundraiser. But most importantly, it couldn't have been possible without the support of listeners who contributed during the fundraiser. To all of the above, thank you for your continued support in making KUAF your indispensable connection to the world. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. For Sunday, November 4th, 2012, I'm Christina Thomas. Earlier, Kyle Kellums and I spoke with Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers, about what's up for this week and this afternoon.
This is one of those stories that makes me so happy to tell.
All right.
There's a new theater company in Fayetteville.
You love new theater
Yay.
Companies.
I do, and it's called Performing Artists of Lifestyles.
Ah.
These are Clients of Lifestyles, which serves adults with disabilities. Uh-huh. You know, they've had a very successful art program. Mm-hmm. And some of them wanted to do theater. So they got themselves a drama teacher, Amy Beaver.
Great.
And they asked the clients, I want to say kids, and that's not appropriate, but they asked the clients what they wanted to do, and they said Shakespeare.
Okay.
Of course.
So what did they got?
And Amy said, oh, my. And then they started work on A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Oh.
And they've done it in great and clever ways. Some of them are harder to hear. They don't speak up loudly enough, or their articulation is not clear enough. So they have readers mm-hmm. to help them. Mm-hmm. Some of them are amazing and have the whole show memorized. The young man playing Oberon still looked like he wondered why he was doing theater, as men often do yes. in high school or community theater. It's part of their College for Living, where the clients learn not just visual art and now drama, but they also learn life skills, right, how to balance your checkbook, grocery shopping, things like that that we probably all need to go see if we can sit in on.
Right.
So this is starting. They started the program with 7 students. They have more than 50 now, and all the kids want to do more. So how you support this first one will probably be the decision point on that. One show only, and they've been working on this for most of a year. So one show only.
When is it?
Thursday night. It conflicts with the 5x5 at ACO.
Okay, you go 5x5, I'll go to this. How's
okay,
that?
That'll work out. It starts at 6 o'clock at their Stensgaard Center. It's $25, including dinner.
Did we
tickets.
Already say the proceeds all proceeds benefit Lifestyles?
Yes,
right?
The proceeds all go back into the College for Living at Lifestyles. And if you could see their faces, it's just fabulous.
And it takes place where again?
At their Stensgaard Center, their new building, big new building.
Right off the bypass. Right, you can see it from the bypass.
Right.
Yeah.
And you need to make reservations, 521-3521. So let me know how it goes.
Okay.
All right. Also this afternoon, big afternoon for a Sunday, drop-in drawing at Crystal Bridges from noon to 3. A cooking demo with Vince Pianalto, part of the Wheat, Fresh, and Pasta series at the Botanical Garden. That starts at 1 o'clock, and it's $5 or $10. There's a film at the Fayetteville Public Library, a classic folk comedy about a man and his daughter who decide to become traveling musicians. Plus, they're doing a little Yiddish workshop.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Yiddle with His Fiddle, and it starts at 1 o'clock.
All right.
The Tawny Town, wow, we are multicultural. The Tawny Town Polenta Smear is today from 1:30 to 4 at St. Joseph Parish Hall in Tawny Town. Lots of Tawny Town history, photo exhibits, genealogy information, and free samples of polenta.
Yummy.
Claire Deedles has a fiber art show.
Yeah, this is something quite different.
She calls it, I've forgotten, crochet collage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really cool looking. And the opening reception is from 2 to 4 today at Ozark Folkways in Winslow. If you don't know Claire, she was a music professor forever at the university. And she's really excited about this. Shrek wraps up today at 2 and 7:30 at the Walton Arts Center. Big green guy, funny ears. Music that sounds like it came from a classic musical from Brigadoon or any of those. Very interesting. The lyrics sound more like they came from Avenue Q.
Okay.
So since it's Jason Moore's show, not surprising. And You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, is at 3 o'clock at the Berry Performing Arts Center at JBU in Siloam Springs.
And
The Flaming Lips.
Wait,
tonight at Barnhill Arena.
Heck yes.
Tickets are $35. There may be some left at 443-5600.
All right. That's going to be a lot of fun.
Thanks, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Sunday. It's the 4th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of Will Rogers, born near Claremore, Oklahoma, 1879, the youngest of 8 children. His father was a successful rancher. The boy never graduated from high school, started performing in rodeo shows. He did roping tricks. His father tried to get him into a military academy, but the boy ran away, got on a boat to South America, took off for Africa, performed in a Wild West show over there, then circuses in New Zealand and Australia, found his way back to this country, performed in vaudeville shows in New York City. And he went on to become a Broadway showman, a Hollywood actor, a traveling public speaker, radio commentator, and a newspaper columnist. Will Rogers, who said, "I joked about every prominent man of my time, but I never met a man I didn't like." It was on this day in 1918 the poet Wilfred Owen was killed in World War I at the age of 25. He knew that the war was almost over, the Germans were retreating, but he was trying to get his men across a canal in the early morning hours when they were attacked by enemy fire, and he was fatally wounded. The war ended the following week. It's the birthday of the poet C.K. Williams, born in Newark, New Jersey, 1936. decided to be a poet and dropped out of college to move to Paris because that's where he thought a poet ought to live. He didn't write while he was there, but he did realize that he didn't know anything and he should probably go back to college. He said it was an incredibly important time. Not much happened, and yet my life began then. I discovered the limits of loneliness. And it's the birthday of the novelist Charles Frazier, born in Asheville, North Carolina, 1950. His father researched the family history, and one day he told Frazier that one of their ancestors, Frazier's great-great-uncle, had been a Confederate soldier who had deserted the Confederate Army and walked more than 250 miles to his home near Cold Mountain. And Frazier realized he could use that to write a novel. So he took a sabbatical. It stretched from 2 into 7 years. The book was Cold Mountain. It came out in 1998, went on to sell about 2 million copies, and won the National Book Award. His newest novel, Night Woods, is set in the Appalachian Mountains of the 20th century. Here's a poem for today by Jane Kenyon, Twilight After Haying. Yes, long shadows go out from the bales, and yes, the soul must part from the body. What else could it do? The men sprawl near the baler, reluctant to leave the field. They talk and smoke, and the tips of their cigarettes blaze like small roses in the night air. It arrived and settled among them before they were aware. The moon comes to count the bales, and the dispossessed whippoorwill sings from the dusty stubble. These things happen. The soul's bliss and suffering are bound together like the grasses. The last sweet exhalations of timothy and vetch go out with the song of the bird. The ravaged field grows wet with dew. A poem by Jane Kenyon, Twilight After Haying, from The Boat of Quiet Hours, published by Gray Wolf Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, the oldest monthly devoted to verse in the English-speaking world, you can join its centennial celebration and become a subscriber at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Joy Biles, engineered by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Bentonville, Fort Smith, and Jane, Missouri. Omni 350 meets today from 1:30 to 3 at the Fayetteville Public Library in the Ann Henry Boardroom. This month, the discussion is about a new state energy plan as an opportunity to create jobs, save money, and position Arkansas as a leader in the growing advanced energy sector. 445-6567 for more information. Weekend Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas. Antoinette Grajeda will be bringing you a brand new daily edition tomorrow. For now, happy Sunday.